this music is making me do sort of David Byrne-like dancing in here. And it's not a pretty sight. Thank God this is radio. So we're going to be talking about books today. We're talking to two different authors. I was looking for a good through line, and there is one, which is that in each case, the author's book is heavily influenced by a work that came before. In fact, a work that came before in each case becomes part of the structure of the book, part of the arc of the book. So a little later in the show today, we'll be talking to Colin McCann. His new book is called 13 Ways of Looking. I probably don't. Particularly this being in Connecticut and me sitting in Hartford and all this stuff, I shouldn't have to tell you which literary work 13 Ways of Looking owes some of its structure to. But anyway, we'll be talking to him about that and also about the fact that many of you know last year in New Haven, he had this horrible incident in which he tried to intervene in a what was essentially a domestic or marital dispute, but it was taking place kind of on the sidewalks of New Haven, and he was badly injured by the assailant. I mean, badly injured. So we'll be talking about that as well and how it kind of seeps into the work. We're going to begin with a guest we've had before and we've enjoyed a great deal. A few years ago, Sloane Crosley was with us for a show about proms, and we liked her so much. And then we sat around for years saying, when will Sloane Crosley come back? Is there like a bat signal that we can show against the sky to make Sloane Crosley come back? And it turned out we just had to wait for her to write a book, and it's called The Clasp. And her version of what Wallace Stevens is to Colin McCann is de Maupassant's The Necklace, which becomes something of one of the engines kind of thrusting this book into the sky. Sloane Crosley, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me. That signal would have been.
What would have been? It would be a dried mango.
A silhouette of a necklace, probably, yeah. For the book.
Boy, you're always thinking promotion, and I like that.
I can't help it.
I was thinking dried mango. You were thinking necklace. Who's to say either one really defines you and who you are?
So, well, one makes a prettier silhouette, but go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I think a dried mango could look nice.
Sure.
The moon's a dried mango on some nights.
No.
So we have to, it sounds like a Jimmy Webb song or something. But anyway, we have to get right down to brass tacks here and talk about this book, which, so I've got my blurb for it. You can feel free to use it. I think it's sort of the contemporary, madcap, fun version of All the Light You Cannot See. You know?
Because, that sounds great.
Because it's kind of a jewel thing, you know. They're both kind of jewel things, and they traverse some of the same geography, too, if you think about it. And so it's kind of, you know, run with that anyway. So, none of that's helping anybody who's listening right now. Sloane Crosley, tell us a little bit. Give people your thumbnail of this book. Or just give
my
us your
elevator
thumbnail.
Pitch for the
yeah,
book.
Exactly.
Or just give
seconds.
Your thumbnail. That's also nice. I start screaming on the radio. Yeah. It's a love triangle and a comedy of manners about three friends who reunite after being estranged for about 10 years post college. And they reunite at a wedding. And then the book goes from Miami, New York, LA, Paris. And then the latter half takes place in Normandy as one of these three friends, the most sort of Eeyore and Job-like of all of them. You know, he doesn't get the girl. His apartment gets broken into. All this, you know, at one point in the first early draft, I had him fall off a bike, you know. Mm-hmm. He becomes obsessed with the idea that the necklace behind Guy de Maupassant's famous short story, The Necklace, is real. And he decides to go after it, hence the taking place in France. And I think what I wanted to do with it is, you know, there's a sort of subgenre of the coming-of-age story that I would call the coming-of-age too-late story. Mm-hmm. It's in like – in movies, it's in like The Big Chill or all of Noah Baumbach's movies, I guess. Mm-hmm. In books, it would be in The Group or The Emperor's Children by Claire Massoud. And I just wanted to do a sort of fun, comedic, physical manifestation of that.
Well,
and that's The Clasp.
So that raises a semi-uncomfortable question, which is, so you just named a whole bunch of different works of literature and cinematic works and stuff like that. And we could also throw in all the comedies that are on HBO almost are about sort of people who've hit their 20s or early 30s, and it's kind of, you know, not really sure. working out the way they wanted to. But so then the question is, how generation specific is this book? I will say, first of all, I was vastly entertained by this book, and I'm certainly not its target demographic.
Thank you.
So, but I was, you know, very involved in their problems and very amused by their predicaments, and I certainly recognized myself in various characters. So that's the good news. It's not that generation specific because I'm really, really, really old. But on the other hand,
on the radio,
that's right. On the other hand, there is a way in which, right, that there's, I mean, every generation is lost for a while, but there's maybe kind of a, there's, right. Well, let's use the phrase quarter life crisis. This is kind of a quarter life crisis book, right?
Well, they're older than that. They're 29, 30, but that still makes them 7 years younger than I am if we're doing math.
Also, people live a lot longer.
People live a lot longer. So a couple of things I think are going on why hopefully I can guess why you're connecting to it, which is good. One is that a sort of larger point of the story, which I didn't mention in my elevator pitch, is that I've always been attracted to works of art that are about other works of art. I mean, like you said, I mean, I'm looking forward to Colm on the second half of the show. So, you know, you think of Zadie Smith on Beauty or Ann Patchett, Bel Canto, that's opera, or, you know, Donna Tartt, The Goldfinch. And so this is sort of a tribute to this short story. And that's a genre that is not generational. That doesn't matter. And the other thing is I'm very lucky in that a lot of the positive press has said that I've sort of, you know, this is about millennials. And I'll take it because it's a compliment, you know, but I didn't – it's a little bit embarrassing to finally admit that actually I wasn't intending to write about millennials. This is just this period of time and how I think. And I think that similarly, you know, the book is told from two-thirds of a male perspective. But it's not like I did extensive research into the male psyche. I just lived in the world and wrote about it. So it's not – And it's sort of comforting when people say it sounds accurate because then maybe it means, well, millennials, they're just like us, or men, they're just like us, you know?
Millennials, they're almost human.
They're almost human. I mean, I think the marker of millennials, or what we've been told is the marker, is that they're a bit disappointed. You know, it's like, I never promised you a rose garden. Like they just – They're marked by this idea that they were told that they could do anything, and which is on the surface positive, but maybe has some negative ramifications when you try to hire one as your assistant. But the truth is that that's really the only part of them that's millennial, and disappointment is not generational as much as we're pinning it all on them. I mean, I know plenty of disappointed 18-year-olds. I know plenty of really disappointed 45-year-olds. It happens.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I think beyond that, I mean, one of the things that I was thinking about here, I was down at my former university a couple of weeks ago to do something else. And somebody came up to me who works for the alumni magazine. And I had never seen this person before in my life. But he said, well, you know, hello, blah, 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 about this and that and radio stuff. And then he said, and by the way, I really enjoyed your class note the other day. And I was standing there with one of my classmates. And my class note was and who started chuckling. Because my class note was, like most class notes, a little bit self-congratulatory. But I also, like, mentioned all this negative stuff that had happened in my life. and
you should.
Yeah, but that's what people don't do, right? And so one of the things about this book is it is very much the story. That's what we do with ourselves. We're actually all writing class notes all the time, and they're lies for the most part.
Oh, well, that's what Facebook was invented for.
And it's what life was invented for. It was happening well before Facebook. So your three characters are kind of, you know, although one of them, the Eeyore-ish one, doesn't make much of a pretense to not being miserable. But everybody's sort of looking at everybody else. And I guess maybe this is very Facebook-y. You know, everybody's looking at everybody else and going, well, obviously he or she is having a better life than I am. Things are working out a lot better. And it's sort of about that private hell that each person is in. You know what I'm talking about?
Right. Oh, I definitely do. I mean, I think that if you spend all your energy on the mask of appearances, as these three characters tend to do, you know, there's a hollowness that happens inside. And I feel like this story is really about them falling almost like dominoes into sincerity, right? So you have Victor, who falls asleep on the mother of the groom's bed at this wedding I mentioned, a little bit drunk, and she wakes him up. And he's sort of the first one to want out, to think, you know, my life is not going the way I want. I'm just going to toss everything and go and look to the future. Or if you think of them as the ghost of Christmas past, present, and future. Mm-hmm. And then there's Kezia, who works for this crazy jewelry designer, and she's just trying to act as if and make sure everything is status quo. And then you have Nathaniel, who would be perfectly happy with that image. You know, he's happy to be pigeonholed as the cool guy from college, even though he hasn't been working very well in LA and he hasn't been doing very well and he's sort of in financial ruin. But they're all – what I like about them is that they can't keep up that facade for long because they've known each other for so long.
That's right. I mean, it is, it's about how you can't lie quite as successfully to your college friends.
Right.
But I think it's also, I mean, I was sort of thinking about you and Colin McCann, each of your books has to do kind of with where hell is located, you know, I mean, in life, where is hell located? Now, obviously, your characters ultimately, hell is a somewhat comic place for them to be, but still, they are kind of in hell. And I think for them, hell is missed connections, or it's sort of the anti-E.M. Forster book, right? Only connect.
Right. Except that, only connect. Speaking of Zadie Smith, right.
Right.
I mean, I think that hell is and then maybe this does become generational to millennials a little bit. Hell for them is wanting to be obsessed with something and having nothing to be obsessed with. Mm-hmm. So this is sort of, you know, the way I first started talking about the book to my editor when we were working on early drafts. I said, it's like Possession, but funny, you know, and he's like, I don't actually understand what that means or what that would possibly, what would that possibly entail? But I mean, the idea of wanting so desperately to have something concrete and to not feel so adrift. I mean, that's what everyone tells you about everything. I mean, not to turn this into a self-help hour, but there's really nothing lonelier than being in a relationship when you feel alone. That is much lonelier than being single. And same thing when you haven't found your people, your group of friends. There are whole movies that are made about this, plays, operas. And what really the lesson of the CLASP is that the question is, all of these people are asking them, do I hold on, or CLASP, as it were, to the relationships that are in front of me, or do I sort of jettison them and move on? And they're at that point, which I think is a point that people come to if you've ever had a friendship where you think, okay, I'm just going to make one more phone call and then can we call this? Are we done? You know, if I don't go on this weekend with everybody, am I going to be invited on the next one? And it turns out, of course, over the course of the book that they're not strangers, that they are family. But that's yeah, that misconnection is certainly hellish for all of them. They just don't realize it.
So let's extend this metaphor or this concept to you. So prior to this, you were known for writing comic essays, where, in fact, the level of connection with your material is different. I say this as someone who's written a lot of comic essays. So, I mean, your books were I Was Told There'd Be Cake and How Did You Get This Number? And so when you write a comic essay, I mean, you're really just trying to engage with somebody a certain way, right? It's not your whole life story. It's not their whole life story. You're just trying to get them to see something that's kind of funny for a little while. And so the kind of conversation that we just had about life is something, for the most part, that comic essayists, I would argue anyway, hold at bay. Because, you know, in 1,000 words, you're just better off not thinking about any of those really big questions. So how much
– Avert your eyes.
Totally. So how much of a transition was this for you? I mean, you're talking like a novelist now. You sound like a novelist.
Wow.
And, you know, you're talking big picture, deep questions. But I guess what I'm saying is that meant you kind of had to do something similar to what your characters had to do, which is connect to characters and to life questions in a much bigger and sincere and less guarded way. I don't know. Would you accept that argument?
I would accept it. I mean, I think it still is a comedic novel. I mean, it's almost like cleaning. It's like the house is set on fire. What do you take? You know, like the passport, the cat, and some photos or something like that. I mean, if you imagine the essay house being set on fire temporarily, I mean, I'll go back. I thought, what do I take with me? You know, and I think the tone, the humor, the observations, although to your point, I mean, for essays, you're really only selling someone on one concept, and that is the concept of your voice and yourself and the authority you have to use it and to deploy it. And you have to do a lot of selling with a novel. You know, there's a cast of characters. There's 3 main characters here, but there's probably a total of about 15. And I had to sell myself on them first. And part of that is in a way, withholding jokes, do you know, and making sure that they're different. So just because I have a character in a situation where I know that if I was sitting at that restaurant, let's say, I would observe X, Y, Z, maybe that character wouldn't. And so it's learning how to hold it back until they become kind of real to you. And so I think the other difference really is that essays get ready because this is going to be very profound.
Yeah, I'm ready. I'm busy.
Is everyone sitting?
I have my seat in its upright position. Good. My tray table is locked in place.
Tray table's locked and loaded. Okay. Essays end. They do it all the time. They just keep doing it. So you can bring a thought to its completion. In some cases, depending the length or the idea or the nature or complexity of the essay, I've had the final two lines in my brain before I started, and I just had to get there. It was the journey to get there. And then you can move on to a new stream of thought. Whereas a novel, I mean, this took me about 4.5 years to write, and you have to consistently water it and keep building this world and be responsible for everything. And just a different set of things than you're responsible for in essays.
Were you pretty confident you'd be able to do this? I mean, the world of humorous essay writers or comedic essay writers, I mean, we can each of us probably name some of our favorite people who just couldn't do this. I mean, the person who really inspired me to start doing it is Roy Blunt Jr. I think he's written one novel, but it certainly just doesn't really loom.
Great.
It doesn't loom. His novel doesn't really loom large among Roy's works. Roy turns out to work so beautifully in other kinds of formats. And I know for you, Fran Lebowitz might be another example of somebody who just...
That's a really good one. Yeah. Or Dorothy Parker, actually, while we're at it.
Yeah. So did that cause anxiety in you? Like, what if I'm more like them?
Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, of course it did. But at the same time, I had a hunch only because I started writing fiction. I mean, I just didn't publish it. Mm-hmm. So I've written stories my whole life. I wrote a pretty terrible novel when I was about 22, which will never see the light of day. And I mean that. That's not like a post, you know, no one should go through the drawer and find it. It's genuinely not worth it. But, you know, I always wanted to do this. And I, you know, I worked at Random House in the vintage books publicity department for about 10 years and largely worked with authors of fiction and not nonfiction, and was really immersed in that world. And I've always loved short stories. I would say I have an equal amount of anthologies than I do novels, or almost, on my bookshelves at home. And so it's always sort of been my world. And I fell backwards into nonfiction. And this is not to say that it wasn't work once I fell there. And I don't love it. And I'm not going back. And it's very much who I am. But it's not what I set out to do. And so knowing that I started in this direction, even if no one saw it, helped give me a little bit of a boost, I think, when I was alone in my room writing it.
So, yeah. There's that whole thing. I think Fran Lebowitz brought it up, the whole idea of, do you hear your characters talking to you? You know, and I think if you haven't written fiction, you haven't written a novel, and you hear other people say it, you either think that's really crazy or really pretentious or...
Pretentious.
Yeah, or that could never happen to me or something like that, right? I assume you have a whole different relationship with that whole question now.
Well, what happened was, is it just happened a little more slowly. Like, you know, they say the first child, long labor, I suppose, would be a sort of graphic analogy. I started doing, you know, writing the novel, and I had these different sort of disparate character sketches, and I was very concerned with not only making sure I wrote a man realistically, but making sure I wrote two very different men realistically. And then, you know, I always – at first it started in the negative. So at first it started with, okay, well, suddenly I'm 100 pages in and I know that a certain character, if you gave me a line, I know who wouldn't say that. Do you know?
Yeah.
And then I really – I knew they were made up. I felt close to them, but I was very conscious. I am a sane person. I knew they weren't living in my house. I mean, they certainly weren't paying rent, I'll tell you that much. And then – only when I handed in the novel, the last draft, I got really sad because I thought these people are never going to be able to speak for themselves again. And
until the Noah Baumbach
movie. I realized
movie.
I thought of them as people. Yeah. Until the Noah Baumbach movie, exactly. But even then, that's, you know, a different form until I, you know, write about them through poetry or my album of ukulele music. But in this form, this is what they have to say. And I realize I miss them. And so it's actually kind of not so much a chore but a delight talking about them like this and promoting the book because it's the only chance I get to talk about them.
Speaking of promoting the book, Sloane Crosley, whose novel The Clasp we are talking about, will be at RJ Julia on Tuesday, October 27th, otherwise known as tomorrow, at 7 p.m. You know, I just realized something, too, which is that when I was down there at my university talking to the alumni notes person, I was following you. I was doing something that you had just done, which is, weren't you the token goy on Unorthodox?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I think I was the next one
Token going on
Unorthodox podcast. I think you're called Gentile of the Week is what it's called. I thought I saw your name on the list.
You did, except for one very important thing.
All right.
I am 100% Jewish. 100%.
Oh, so you weren't the Gentile of the Week. You were the other thing.
No.
I was the Gentile of the Week.
No, I am the control in the experiment.
Because I was gonna ask you what questions that you – see, I had to show up with questions. You know, the Gentile has to show up with
about
the questions.
Jews.
About Jews, yeah.
Yeah, no, I thought you were going to say no. I was given this crazy name because my grandfather's name was Cantor. And he was told he would never make it in business as a Jewish person, which I don't know who told him that. But he was sitting in the office of a man who had a Crosley radio on his desk. And that is literally, he thought, okay, that'll do. And that's how I got my last name. And then my first name comes from a terrible Charlton Heston movie my mom was watching while she was pregnant. So I am thoroughly Jewish and just happen to be walking around with this crazy name.
Well, I'm proud of myself for not knowing that. It's sort of like, I don't know what the version of I don't see color is, you know, that we would apply to that. But some version of that anyway.
Some version of that, exactly.
So, but one of the things, speaking of promoting books and speaking of being at RJ Julia tomorrow night. So, you know, you did come from this background and I assume you've watched a lot of books not get promoted right, not get talked about right, books that you really thought were good back when you worked in publishing that just didn't get the kind of air they needed to survive inside the bell jar. So and you've done a lot of stuff, right, to make sure that that doesn't happen. You want to mention one or two?
I've tried my very best.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, I think the thing is, you know, I don't think this is going to come as a shock to anyone who's listening, but the, you know, publishing has gotten increasingly crowded and there is less space and, you know, less room for all these different voices. And it's funny, someone asked me the other day about, you know, are there room for all the essayists and all the women and all that stuff? And theoretically, yes, I think everybody has a right to their voice and a right to write it down. But logistically, kind of not. I mean, there's less ad space in magazines. And so then there's less, you know, the arts section is the first thing to get cut. And all of a sudden, there's two book reviews in a magazine where there used to be room for six. And so you have to think about other sort of creative ways to try to promote your book. And the other thing about this particular book, it was, you know, as much of a torture as it is to write an almost 400-page book, it's also fun. I mean, and hopefully you can feel it. And one of the fun, I thought, well, if we can't have fun promoting it, there's something wrong with all of us. So I did a book trailer with Amanda Seyfried and her dog. And the concept of the book trailer is that Finn, the dog, has read the book and they're in a book club together and Amanda has not, which was difficult to write. And then I had a friend who runs a jewelry company called Lulu Frost who made a necklace based on the necklace that I found in a sketch in the New York Public Library that I decided could conceivably, just the year it was done, could conceivably have been the necklace that Guy de Maupassant was thinking of when he wrote that famous short story. Mm. Probably not, but I just wanted some inspiration. And so I plucked it down from off my desk and I brought it to Lisa and I said, what do you say to making a necklace based on this? And so, you know, that stuff is really fun. I wouldn't have made a book trailer if I didn't have a good idea for it. You know, it can sort of fall on deaf ears if you're just going through the motions of promotion. You know, if you're just thinking, well, I should make a postcard for this because I have the paper. You know, I don't think anyone really cares. But the idea is to do something that's integrated with the book that sort of genuinely brings it to life and hope anyone pays attention.
Yeah. I thought I also read something that involved yarn bombing or something, which a concept I don't even really understand.
So I went to I did a piece on a woman who she's an artist, and she basically, if you've ever seen a picture of something like a bicycle or a fire hydrant or a pole coated in yarn,
yes,
that looks like it's got a koozie of some sort on it, cozy, mm-hmm. koozie, Actually, I think beer is the koozie and a sweater is the cozy.
Right. They're both available at the Sloane Crosley store.
They're
however,
both available. They are absolutely not. Please don't. No, I'm kidding. But she and I became quite good friends, this woman, Magda Sayegh, and she lives in Austin. And so for my Austin reading, she knit my book into a little – she knit a little sweater around my book. And so I've been reading from it. And I look like a girl in seventh grade whose mother has sort of gone overboard covering her textbooks, you know. but it's been fun to read from it. I mean, that's the other thing that's fun is – and they're all – I mean, I think it's maybe by coincidence. I don't know. Maybe it's subconscious. But all the sort of artists that I've been soliciting to help me out are women. Wendy McNaughton, who's an illustrator in San Francisco, did a poster for my reading that's coming up there on the West Coast. Just because it's – it's fun, and in a way it chimes with the book because the whole book, as you said at sort of the beginning of the show, is an interpretation of someone else's art, mm-hmm. in a way. And so why not sort of extend that?
Sloane Crosley, it's so great to talk to you. Once again, tomorrow night, RJ Julia, I don't know if you'll get to see the book cozy or not. Will you be actually bringing that with you?
Well, now I feel a pressure to bring that one.
Well, yeah,
I think
people are going to be storming out if it's not
there.
They'll
be clamoring.
Right. And definitely think merch here. You know, you're perched on the edge of merch, right?
I'm this close to a T-shirt.
Yeah, yes. Absolutely. No, so much more. You're thinking way too narrowly. Think big, big horizontal expanse of merch.
You're right.
All
dirigible.
Right. The book is The Class by Sloane Crosley. Thanks for visiting with us again.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. We're going to take a little break here. We'll come back. We hope we'll come back with Colin McCann. I gather he's a little elusive at the moment.
The song goes out to you. I'm 25 with no direction in my life. And it's Friday night and I'm doing all right. I can't complain, but I can and I do.
So you were promised Colin McCann. At the moment, we don't have him. In fact, if you're with Colin McCann right now, could you please remind him he's supposed to be on the show right now? I'm sure that we'll find him as we go along here. And if we don't, we'll just open the phones. You know, you can talk about the book that you're reading right now. I would be fascinated to actually, I mean, not right this second. You don't have to do that. But I would be fascinated to know that, partly because, as you may know, last week we did this book club thing where I got three literary savants together and we read the new Jonathan Franzen novel, Purity. And people seem to like that. I mean, I asked people to respond at my email, Colin, C-O-L-I-N, at WNPR.org, and they seem to enjoy it. And so we're going to do another one, but I'm not really sure what book we should do. So you could email me and tell me, or if we don't if we don't find Colin McCann, you can call me up and tell me directly what book we should do. Maybe it's a Colin McCann book. I'm not 100% sure. But anyway, so if it comes to that, the number is 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. Don't bother to tweet us. We may need your phone call even more. Although, let me just tell you a little bit about this is sort of my chance to talk because I don't have to ask anybody any questions right now, which could be both a good thing and a bad thing. So, I mean, it is true that this weekend – so let me just back up here. So Colin McCann, just to kind of set the stage for you a little bit too, in 2014 he was down in New Haven. And he did intervene in what appeared to be an incident between a man and his wife. And he was attacked and knocked unconscious. This all happened right outside the Study Hotel where we often do our broadcasts when we're down in New Haven. In fact, I think I did a broadcast from the Study Hotel a week or two after that when we were down there for the Yale Writers Conference. So – and he was – anyway, what happened was he did try to intervene on behalf of this woman. And then he walked away from the scene. He was attacked and knocked unconscious. He didn't see it coming. He suffered multiple injuries. His cheekbone was fractured. He had contusions over both eyes. Several teeth were broken. This is all because he tried to help this woman who'd been knocked to the ground. Anyway, his attacker ran away. He was left there unconscious. He woke up being hoisted into an MRI machine at the Yale New Haven Hospital. It took many, many months to try to recover from this. There were all kinds of horrible complications. As he wrote in his victim's statement to the court, I've spent countless hours in hospital rooms and doctor's offices. I contracted shingles across my optic nerve. I developed high blood pressure directly attributable to traumatic stress and suffered a heart arrhythmia. I experienced severe headaches. I've had to spend an inordinate time dealing with insurance companies and other medical institutions. He was forced to cancel national and international speaking engagements, and it just affected his work. For a long time, he just wasn't even really able to write. It affected his family. It affected his friends. He said in his victim's statement, though, I have forgiven my attacker, but I will never, ever excuse him. My forgiveness will not come at the cost of silence. He assaulted his wife on a public street. Moments later, he assaulted me. Now he is attempting to assault the judicial system by claiming that he should remain unpunished because he is, by his own account, a first-time offender open to rehabilitation. I do not object to the notion of clemency, but I would like to point out that there is no such thing as a first-time victim. To be a victim is permanent. To be a victim is absolute. My attacker ran away. Now he wants the rest of us to look away. Then he said, I do not want my attacker to have jail time. I don't believe that incarcerating him will help in any way. I have no compunction to hurt him any more than he has already hurt himself. However, I do feel that if he was to escape without a conviction in an attempt to walk away with a clean record, as if nothing at all ever happened after his double assault, that justice will not have been served. I believe that he should carry his record around as a reminder to himself of what he is capable of doing and undoing. In terms of sentencing, I would like to recommend that it be something that would aim towards an identifiable moral good, to have him perform community service in a shelter or to volunteer at a late-night emergency ward in addition to financially supporting an organization that doesn't allow for silence when it comes to the abuse of women. So that's Colin McCann actually in his actual official victim's statement to the court. And by the way, if you want to know how that came out, the attacker, the man who attacked both the woman and then him, was sentenced he pled guilty to assault three, reckless endangerment in the first degree, and breach of peace. He received a sentence of 2.5 years suspended sentence with 3 weeks of jail time and 3 years of probation. The judge noted in her remarks that she hoped the defendant fully appreciated the fairness and compassion that was shown in the author's communications with the court. So, anyway, this sort of sets up. Some of you know, I've actually been going to church on a regular basis, really kind of for the first time in my life. I've gone to lots of churches over the course of my life, and way early in my career, it was my job as a journalist to write about religion and about I was the religion writer for the Hartford Courant, and that meant everything from covering the election of a pope to covering Black Pentecostals to covering Hare Krishnas to covering Mormons to – I mean, I spent a lot of time sort of guesting around in churches but never really having any permanent religious affiliation. But as some of you know, as a result of an interview that I did here on the show with Nancy Butler, who's the pastor of Riverfront Family Church in Glastonbury and who has ALS, which – is a horrible and tragic disease that has kind of only one outcome. I went to the church a couple of times to get ready for that interview, and then I just kind of stayed, even though, I mean, I'm still kind of troubled and conflicted in my own beliefs. But one of the things I do believe is that it's great once a week to think about something else, you know? It's great once a week to kind of struggle with these kinds of questions. I mean, the other reason I go to church is because when I come out, I feel better than I went in, so that's a good thing too, right? This past Sunday, I got my son to go with me. It's the first time he's done that, and he's 26 years old. And as we were leaving, it wasn't really the topic that was discussed in church, but as we were driving away from it, we started talking about that whole question of trespass and about – because we have talked a lot about this. And I mean, if you think about it, probably the words most frequently said in the English language every week in the world – think about the world, think about the English language – probably the words of the Lord's Prayer are said by more frequently by more people than certainly anything that I can think of. I mean, millions and millions of people say it, right? Like every week. So there's that whole forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. So what does that mean, you know? And one of the things – so we talked a little bit about that, about the difficulty, the incredible difficulty of ever forgiving people, you know, if they've done something bad to you. But I also – this is when I really started thinking about sample size, that that, you know, as you get older, your sample size just becomes a lot broader and bigger. You know, I mean, all the things that have ever happened to you just are greater in number. And also all the things that you've ever done and all the times that you've done things that you would find extraordinarily difficult to forgive if somebody did them to you. So that, you know, listening to somebody who's 26, and to me that was sort of the interesting juxtaposition of Sloane Crosley, who's a very wise and wonderful young writer, but she's a young writer, and Colin McCann, who's a bit older. You know, how do you think about this stuff? How do things change? Because things look so big when you're 25 or when you're 30. I mean, some fairly minor transgression, somebody who beats you out of $200 somehow. That's is like the worst thing that is imaginable. And then life goes on and you kind of see the world in different terms. So we were just driving along kind of talking about that. And, you know, I think the capacity for forgiveness is one thing. You can forgive. I mean, like, what does that even exactly mean? But you can forgive somebody, but maybe you can never trust them again. I mean, those are two different things, right? You could forgive somebody. You can sort of say, I understand a little bit more about who you are and why you did what you did. I believe maybe that you've changed. I also realize that my inability to forgive you would ultimately hurt me more than forgiving you will. So I'm understanding at maybe a really pure level that I'm much better off forgiving you, that part of the hell that I'll create if I don't forgive you, it'll hurt me. So I can do. But can you ever trust that person again? To me, people will forgive you for anything. They will have a hard time trusting you ever again. Anyway, that's so much in what Colin McCann has written about. And I'm trying to see who's up on the board there. I think what we're going to do is we'll take a quick break, we'll regroup, and we'll come back after this.
Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, Kyone Wolf. Our interns are Amanda Gallagher, Zachary LaSala, and Deborah Timms. Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin, and the part of Bill Curry was played by the Eagles. For show pages, articles, and every video of the Faith Middleton Show staff we've ever mentioned, visit our website WNPR.org/Colin. Tomorrow, our World Series prep show. Now, back to Colin.
All right, so let me tell you about a few of those things. See, the thing is, like, I used to do this every day. For 16 years, I was on WTIC, and I, for the most part, didn't really have that many guests. You know, I just kind of spread out the newspapers and talk about whatever I was interested in. And I'm perfectly happy to do that, although I wish I'd spent this morning reading the newspapers instead of reading the new Colin McCann book. But anyway, so a few things. Tomorrow, we are going to do a show. I think it'll be a mostly fun but occasionally serious show on the eve of the World Series. And so we're so fortunate to have Doug Glanville, former major leaguer, joining us, along with baseball savant Steve Metcalf and Ginny Apple, for many years a sports columnist for the Hartford Current. So they'll be our guests. And if you haven't been readying yourself for the World Series, if you're the kind of person who doesn't pay that much attention to baseball, But kind of at the last minute, you kind of want to know who's in the World Series and what's going on and who's the guy they call the Dark Knight and, you know, all that kind of thing. Who are those Kansas City Royals anyway? So we'll sort of get you ready for that in a fun way. But we'll also talk to you about some of the controversies that are going on kind of from a fan's perspective. For example, baseball these days is kind of – it's drowning in these video review plays, which in some cases reveal things that – would just otherwise go unknown. For example, I mean, they've discovered that a lot of times when a base runner slides into a bag, his even though he slides in, it looks like his foot's touching the bag the whole way, there might be this tiny little moment of a, you know, micro fraction of half of 1/8 of an inch where there's just his foot isn't entirely in contact with the bag, where no human eye ever could have detected that, but they can do that with the video reviews. And it raises almost kind of a Kantian question, like an epistemological question. I mean, should we know about something that we couldn't know about any other way? And if we do, should we let that affect how we judge certain things? So anyway, we'll be talking about stuff like that tomorrow. A couple of things also. This is a good chance for me to clear the decks of things that people have been asking me to talk about that I haven't had time to. And so that's what I'll do. Somebody has asked me to talk a little bit about winter farmers markets. As you know, the Coventry Farmers Market, the biggest farmers market in Connecticut, will be, as we know it, gone, although it seems to be resurrecting in some brand new form. The people who put it on for years announced they weren't going to do it anymore. There was a great rending of garments and gnashing of teeth and crunching of broccoli. And then it turns out that it's going to go forward. So there's going to be a winter farmers market, I think, starting November 15th in Coventry at the high school there. But there's also a lot of people going down on Saturdays to a winter farmers market. I don't know when it starts, but it's Saturdays in Stonington, beautiful Stonington. And there's some kind of reclaimed, well, it's not some kind, I've been there. There's a reclaimed factory space where they'll be having on Saturday mornings and early afternoons, I think, a farmers market. They've been doing that for quite some time, but many of the people from Coventry are, I think, now adding their talents and their produce down there. And then please not to forget New Haven. New Haven, the beautiful Worcester Square's farmers market, goes inside to a location that I would be unable to describe to you. I've been to it. I don't really know what it's called. But if you look it up, it's City Seed is actually the entity in New Haven that runs that farmers market. And then the last thing I have to tell you is that on Thursday night of this week, I am going to be speaking at a nearby – I wish I had all the details in front of me, but Dan Okrent, the guy who – I mean, Dan Okrent is responsible for so many interesting things, ranging from rotisserie baseball to the play Old Jews Telling Jokes to a book about the Prohibition to what am I missing? There's like a whole bunch of other stuff like that. Dan Okrent and I will be on stage Thursday night. I don't know. Maybe if you Google both of us. Both of our names, you'll find out how you can get tickets. But I don't think it's sold out yet, but it might very nearly be. So we're still waiting for Colin McCann, but my guess is that he's not going to show up here. So how is it possible that David Mitchell is calling? Does David Mitchell, does he sort of help out in emergency situations where Colin McCann isn't here? The author of The Bone Clocks is on the line, I think from Ireland. Hi, are you there?
Hello there. Yes, I am here. That sounds like an interesting afternoon you're having.
Well, yes. Well, I mean, it's sort of nice sometimes if things kind of fall apart. And
I think so.
And you get to talk about other stuff. So now I'm trying to connect some of our themes to your work on very short notice. But one of the things that I've been talking a lot about, because it's very much in Colin McCann's book and in Colin McCann's life these days, is how people deal with the whole question of trespasses against them, how they cope with the whole question of forgiveness, you know, how we take the wrongs that are committed against us and either we're able to process them and turn them into forgiveness and a sense of atonement or not. And that's something that runs through some of your work, right? Give me your reaction to that.
My reaction to that, well, firstly, Colm, who I know slightly, he is a great writer, and this is one of his core themes. Perhaps in my case, it's more of a peripheral theme, but what I would say, I suppose, on the subject is I've noticed in my own life, and I guess this feeds into my work as well, you don't so much forgive people for their benefit, but more for your own. few things will just gnaw away at your soul than a grudge. And so it may take time. And, of course, it, I suppose, depends upon the magnitude of the crime or the misdemeanor that was committed against you. But I think forgiveness isn't just a nice, inverted commas, Christian virtue, although I'm sure, of course, all the world's main religions would and should advocate the same. But it's more of a part of a healing process. When a wrong is done against you, at some point, however long it takes, you have to get to a place where you can forgive the offender. Because if you don't, it does you more harm all over again. Does that make any sense?
That makes a tremendous amount of sense. And I think the other thing that we have to realize, and I think as a novelist, it's something that probably occurs naturally to you, is that that when we are the trespasser, when we are the transgressor, usually we're creating our own hell for ourselves anyway. I mean, I know in my own life, when I was the most transgressive, when I was doing the most things for which I would eventually have to seek atonement or forgiveness or something, you would think that that would be a time of great gratification because you're granting yourself such license. You're breaking rules. You're not really worrying so much about hurting other people. You're whatever.
That's right. That's
true. And I was completely miserable during that time.
Yeah, it's true. Our culture is hung up on this freedom word, and we think freedom is this suspension of rules and regulations. When we're in that phase you're talking about, and often as males, it's sort of when we're late teenagers / early 20s, we do discover that these social norms that we think we're being so brave and bold and historically singular by breaking, they're there for a really good reason, and it's not just for the benefit of the transgressed against, but for the transgressor as well. I don't know if you know that Crosby, Stills and Nash song Chicago,
yes,
by Graham Nash.
Mm-hmm.
Would that ring any bells?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. I recently read a really interesting review with an interview with Graham Nash, and the interviewer asked him a really good question that it's good to put to these rockers of a certain vintage. Is there a certain line or lyric that you wrote in one of the songs you're famous for that you now wish you hadn't? And Graham Nash picked on that line from that song, Chicago,
yeah.
and it goes, rules and regulations, who needs them, throw them out
right.
the door.
Yeah.
And in the interview, Nash was saying, I really regret that line on a daily basis, because not all rules and regulations, and you mustn't follow them unthinkingly, but a lot of them are there for really good reasons. So you have me and Graham Nash agreeing with you.
Right. That gets to something I was saying before you came on, which is about sample size. You know, as we get older, we have a bigger sample size. We begin to sort of see things a little bit differently. Hey, we're kind of burying the lead here, which is that Slade House, your brand new novel, comes out tomorrow. So we've only got about a minute or so left, but this is...
Okay. Well, we've had a great conversation.
Yeah, that's fine. That's true.
It's the Slade House.
Yeah.
It's my new novel. It's out tomorrow on your side of the Atlantic, in fact, worldwide. And I'm excited about it. It's my first ever fairly short book. I wrote it with almost embarrassing haste, but it was just one of those I didn't have to agonize over. It just arrived pretty fully formed of its own volition. It's essentially a ghost story. It's about a haunted house, although what is one of those? It's about an apparently haunted house with apparent ghosts who turn out to be both less and more than they appear to be at first sight.
And
that's an elevator pitch.
That is a great elevator pitch, and people should get it right now. That way they can read it as it tumbles towards its climax on Halloween of 2015. You can actually sort of finish the book. If you get it right now, you can finish the book in time to be affected in exactly the right way. Thank you so much, David Mitchell, for appearing out of nowhere. I don't really know how that happened, but that was great. Thanks to Betsy Kaplan and Kion Wolf for keeping their cool heads about them on this show.